discussing the cleanup order. It's a workshop about developing another cleanup order, and that didn't. Why did it didn't go, Lisa? This red circle came on, but it didn't go.
Did you see my question?
It's the
third. So you're going to have to do it.
The inside, you have to avoid hitting all the other buttons. And right is up, left is back.
That's what I was pushing, this.
To change the slides?
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, well, we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
So first, a quick introduction from me. Then Esther Tracy is going to go over the ground rules. So Gita, our beloved Gita, could not be with us here tonight, and Esther is going to do a fine job standing in for Gita. Then Lori Kemper will do the staff presentation. Kevin Sullivan will give the presentation for PG&E. And then we can have a discussion, and Esther will facilitate the discussion the same way Gita has done in the past. You're going to have to advance it. It's not working. So just to get everybody on the same page about what it is Lahontan can do. What we have the legal authority to do is to require dischargers to clean up pollution in groundwater. That means we have the legal authority to set a cleanup level. The cleanup level can be potentially as low as background levels or within the range of between background and the 10 parts per billion MCL. We can set deadlines by which time cleanup must occur. We can set interim deadlines within that to meet certain requirements. We can enforce violations of Lahontan's orders. We cannot tell the discharger how to meet those standards. That's for the discharger to decide. Now, we are fully aware that there are lots of other issues that residents of Hinckley are dealing with. But the question remains how those other issues that are not under the authority of Lahontan are going to be addressed. So just a quick recap of the enforcement actions we have taken since 2008. We put out a cleanup and abatement in order in 2008 that required PG&E to contain the chromium plume, to clean up the groundwater, and to evaluate cleanup options. At that time, we set a background level for chromium 6. Next slide. In 2011, the board required PG&E to monitor domestic wells and to provide water to households that had elevated levels of chromium 6. In 2012, the board fined PG&E $3.6 million for failing to contain the plume, and half of that money went to provide clean water supply to the Hinckley School. And also, since then, we have issued 23 orders that request PG&E to investigate questions or to provide technical information. Other actions, the original background report, we had it peer-reviewed by reputable scientists. It was found to be inadequate. So as many of you know, there's a new background study that is being conducted by Dr. Izbicki with USGS, and the results will be available in a few years. Last year, the board certified the final environmental impact report, and PG&E was ordered also to investigate byproducts of the agricultural treatment units and the in-situ remedial zone treatments. And earlier this year, the board issued a new permit that allowed PG&E to expand the agricultural treatment units, which enables faster cleanup of the plume. So tonight, the topic of this workshop is monitoring. So we're in the process of developing a new cleanup and abatement order that will be presented in 2015, in April. And so we are just here to discuss the monitoring components of that plan. So the questions to think about as Mr. Sullivan is presenting his information is how often, at what depths, should PG&E be required to monitor to know where the plume boundary is, and that includes both the main contiguous plume and also the northern areas, to monitor domestic wells, and to monitor to look for impacts from the agricultural treatment units and the in-situ remediation zones. And with that, I'll hand the microphone over to Ed Stair, who will go over the groundworks.
Do you want to announce that we have Spanish translation?
I was going to. good evening, everybody. If there's anyone who is in need of interpretation services, we do have them available. We have headsets, so you're able to go ahead and listen to real-time translations going on. So the ground rules for tonight, please go ahead and use common courtesy. Do not interrupt other speakers. Please listen to each other and be respectful. Come up to the podium when your name is called. We'll be more than happy to listen. Please turn off your cell phone. If there's something important that you do need to go ahead and handle, please step out of the room. And give everyone the opportunity to participate. Time limits we may be imposed, but we will try to give you enough time to address it.
All right, good evening. My name is Lori Kemper. I'm the Assistant Executive Officer for the Lahontan Water Board. And I'm just briefly going to talk about what is, again, the purpose of tonight. So as Dr. Horn mentioned, I'm chief of the prosecution team for the Water Board. So Lisa Dernbach, who's our senior geologist, Ann Holden, and attorneys from the Office of Enforcement, David Boyers is one of them, will be working on crafting a new cleanup and abatement order for the next phase of cleanup, essentially, at Hinckley. And we'll be doing that after taking input at tonight's workshop, and I'm asking folks to provide input tonight or up till about December 1st, then, because we're going to be writing that order, and then we'll put it out for public comment in mid-January for at least 30 days, and we'll probably come back to Hinckley and talk about the details of that order, and then we'll take public comments, and then the board, in kind of an almost quasi-judicial fashion, will have a hearing to decide the final cleanup and abatement order, the final version that they want to adopt, and that's scheduled for April. So tonight is the second of two workshops like this where we've been trying to cover some of the technical issues associated with this new cleanup order. So last time we were here 2 months ago, we talked specifically about how fast the cleanup was occurring and what would be some reasonable time limits and ways to measure cleanup progress. And tonight we're focused on the long-term monitoring, the comprehensive monitoring that goes on out there, as well as the what we're calling capture metrics, which is really making sure that the plume does not further migrate and how to measure that. So we're looking for your input and any questions if you don't understand. It's going to be a pretty technical, heavy night. So, all right. So this just is an outline, again, of this new cleanup order that we'll be developing. There'll be findings that'll include background history of the site and the basis for any of the specific requirements that are in the order. And then the actual order will have these interim cleanup requirements. It'll have the sampling requirements, plume control requirements, and it'll have triggers for contingency or corrective actions. What that means is if PG&E finds chromium increasing or finds some other things occurring in the groundwater that wasn't anticipated, then they'll be required to address some of those matters. The order will also include new replacement water requirements for any situation where a domestic well goes above the new drinking water standard. One of the things the new order won't do is it won't duplicate monitoring requirements that are already in the agricultural treatment permit or the general permit that we have for the in-situ remediation. That's where they inject ethanol, and they also do some things under that permit like freshwater injection. Those two permits right now are already in place, and they have certain requirements for monitoring that will stay in place. So this new cleanup order will refer to those so that everyone knows they're out there, and it will just include these new requirements focused on plume control and assessing the plume size. So, again, I just kind of went over this already. So here we are, November 12th. And then I'm going to just go ahead. That just shows you what we talked about timing-wise. And then, again, here are the specific questions. You're going to hear tonight PG&E's proposal to do some modifications of some of the current monitoring that they're required to conduct, and we're looking for your input as to the approach that they're laying out. So those are the questions. And I wanted to also point out, and I'm gonna return up here after Kevin gets done speaking, just to remind folks of these questions, but in the back there's a one-page handout. I tried to give it to most of the members of the public that summarize, kind of list the specific questions that you're going to be hearing about tonight, just to remind you of those are things we're looking for your input on. All right. And now I have a couple more slides on the purposes of monitoring. That was the one.
That one, yeah. That one.
Yeah, it's just two slides. Okay, so this just gives you kind of an itinerary for this particular item. So I'm going to cover the monitoring purposes, and then Kevin Sullivan will get up. And although the focus of tonight's presentations are on monitoring, Kevin is going to be addressing a couple of questions that came up at the last workshop in September on cleanup timeframes and looking at where the contaminant is and how best to clean it up. And then following the PG&E presentation, then there'll be questions, an opportunity for questions and input from the board members and the public. And then I'll try to do a wrap-up. That's basically how this item's going to go. And then following this item, we'll have just a general status report item from our staff, PG&E, and Dr. Webster from Project Navigator that supports the Community Advisory Committee. So tonight's workshop, the focus is on monitoring, and there are many purposes of monitoring. Specifically, the cleanup order is going to have requirements to continue to delineate or define the extent of the chromium contamination in the Hinckley Valley. And those are the lines that you see on some of these maps, maybe not some of these maps, but some of the maps that you've seen in the past. We put up the quarterly monitoring reports every 3 months on our website that show the 50 parts per billion line for hexavalent chromium and the 10 parts per billion line and the 3, and that gives everybody a sense of where the contamination is occurring in the Hinckley Valley. Those will be continued in the order. And then another purpose of the monitoring will be to track the plume remediation. So that's requiring ongoing monitoring to show that chromium concentrations are truly declining based on the treatment. And part of that is establishing this containment. We've always required PG&E to try to contain the plume. And as the plume shrinks, we're going to need to measure that line differently as the plume heads south, at least the core part of the contamination. And then last, the cleanup order will require domestic well monitoring to make sure that domestic wells aren't impacted by any of the cleanup efforts and that no new contamination migrates to any of the residential wells surrounding the contamination area. So as I mentioned earlier, we have other monitoring that's going to stay in place in these two other permits. And this order will require the monitoring to be conducted in a certain way so that we can assess the long-term effectiveness. I think that's all I have. So now, Kevin, we'll get into the details. And the charts on the wall you can refer to, and there are maybe one more handout in the back in the binder of larger format maps as well as the slides. There's copies of the slides back there. All right, Kevin.
Thank
you.
Okay. Good evening. My name is Kevin Sullivan. I'm the chromium remediation director for PG&E. I've got two parts of the presentation tonight. The first is a follow-up. We're going to not yet talk about the monitoring plan, but we're going to talk a little bit about some of the questions that came up at our last meeting that the board asked that we wanted to be responsive to. Next slide. So some of the questions last time revolved around a technology known as a bioreactor, and I felt that there might have been a misimpression as to what that could do and couldn't do. So specific questions that we heard were, how could the use of a bioreactor affect the modeling results? And then second, I believe one of the board members asked, could a bioreactor be used to treat hotspots? And so we wanted to take a crack at shedding some light on those questions. Next slide. So in the modeling, in the feasibility study, in the environmental impact report, we looked at several different technologies where we used above-ground treatment systems. And think of above-ground treatment systems as sort of just a box. It might be a bioreactor, it might be a filter, it might be some, you know, whiz-bang machine that no one's invented yet, but it takes chromium out of water. You pump chromium and water up, run it through the box, and then re-inject it. The type of the box doesn't really affect what goes on down in the ground. For the modeling purposes, all you need to figure out in the ground is what comes out and then what happens when the clean water gets back in. How the chromium actually goes away in the box is really immaterial for the groundwater model. And so there are several different techniques. The modeling is neutral on which one of those techniques is used. It could be reduction, it could be ion exchange, or it could be a bioreactor. And again, unless you change these wells, either the pumping rate or the location, nothing in the ground will be any different depending on the box. Next slide. And so it turns out that agricultural units combined with freshwater reinjection start to look an awful lot like a pump and treat system. And we kind of did the two side by side here. They're very similar, not exactly identical, but very similar. In the above ground treatment, you pump the water up, treat it, put clean water back in, and you get that general left to right, you know, flow here. With an ATU, you extract the water, you put it on the farm. Most of it is evaporated by the crop. So most of it goes off into the atmosphere or is used up by the plants. A smaller amount re-infiltrates, and then we also supplement that with fresh water injection. So again, it's not identical to a pump and treat system, but it, in many ways it's very similar to a pump and treat type of system. Next slide, please. So the question was asked, could a bioreactor be used to treat hotspots? And the answer is not really effectively. When we looked at above-ground treatment, what we see here is much longer time frames than if we do in-situ treatment down in the ground. And again, this is the analogy that I think I used last time of wringing the sponge. When you're trying to pump the contamination out, some of it sticks to the aquifer below, and you have to keep pushing fresh water through again and again and again and again. And that tends to make the cleanup slow. You see the yellow bar here asks the question, if I use above ground treatment like a bioreactor, how long does it take me to get rid of 80% of the chromium? And in that case, it's about 15 years. If I use in situ treatment, it's gone in about 6 or 7 years. The blue bar is another way to measure success. It says, how long will it take me to get the plume down to 50 parts per billion? With above ground treatment, again, a filter, a bioreactor, what have you, it takes about 20 years. With in situ treatment, it takes about 6 years. So what we're trying to say here is the bioreactor is a different technology. We think it could be useful. It makes clean water, which might be of use to, you know, some other purpose that we haven't, you know, envisioned yet. We'd like to do a pilot study. We'd like to explore it, but we don't view it as sort of a panacea to, you know, pick up a bioreactor and go put it on a hot spot and try to make it better. Okay. Did I do that or did you?
I didn't.
Okay. The other questions that were asked was about differences in the model, the predicted times among the different layers in the cake of the model, right? We took the aquifer, we broke it up into three different layers, and we had what I suspect was a slightly confusing discussion over layer one cleaning up, layer two cleaning up, and layer three cleaning up. And some specific questions that came up that said, how was the initial mass spread out in those layers, and then why is the deep layer predicted to be cleaned up more slowly? I'm going to take a crack at both of those. Next slide. So we went back and did the math, and it turns out that somewhat by design, but somewhat by just coincidence, the mass is distributed evenly among the layers, a third, and a third.
And if you want what might be too much detail, we use the same map to spread out the contamination in 2 and 3, so it makes sense that layer 2 and layer 3 kind of had the same amount because we used the deep data for those. And the shallow data, when you actually look at the map, it's a different shaped plume with different concentrations, and just by coincidence, it came out to be roughly another third. And that seems to be reasonable based on folks who have been looking at the data for a while. And if you kind of hold up a shallow map and a deep map and kind of squint and eyeball, it passes the reasonableness test. Next slide. And so then the question was, why does the deep layer clean up more slowly? And this is the slide that prompted that question. So again, looking at the three different layers and different scenarios, you can see that layer 3 is the fastest for the 50 ppb metric, but layer 1 is the fastest for the 10 ppb metric. Let's go to the next slide. We can talk a little bit about this. The 10 ppb layer cleans up more slowly down here in layer 3. So what we're looking at here, this is layer 1 on the top. That's the upper layer. Just we tried to make it visually the same. Layer 3 is the deep layer. And you'll notice that between now, time 0, and 8 years from now, layer 1 seems to clean up very well. Layer 3 cleans up pretty well, but there's still a lot left in there. And it's like, well, why is that? Well, there's a couple reasons. First of all, the initial mass north of the IRZs, there's more in layer 3 than there is in layer 1. Layer 1 may look bigger, but if you look closely, you'll see layer 3's got some hotter spots. The second is that layer 1 had a head start. Layer 1, we started cleaning up in late 2007. Deep layer 3, just because of the way the IRZs have been built and how they came online, lagged by about 5 years. So deep layer really began in earnest in about 2012. And then lastly, layer 1 cleans up a little bit faster because remember where I showed that slide of the water coming back from the ATU? That hits layer 1, not layer 3. So layer 1 gets a little bit of a boost because there's clean water coming back in from the agricultural reinfiltration. So there's a lot of little subtle things that go on in the model. And again, we'd be happy to, I think this is about the right level of detail to spend tonight on this, but we're happy to go into this as much detail as folk care for. Can I take questions on this while it's fresh? Or
sure, if anyone has any questions.
Yes?
In our last meeting, I asked you the question, what was the highest levels of arsenic in your in situ? And it's been roughly 3 months now, and I think we need an answer on how much is there. And also, I was wondering what the uranium levels in your in situ area is. And I was told by Bob Doss that arsenic dissipates after a short while, but if you guys are containing the plume, it seems like that it will highly concentrate. And what is the contingency plan if it does get out of the box? You're going to wait until it gets over the MCL before we supply household water. I have a lot of concerns, our community has a lot of concerns about arsenic getting in their domestic wells.
Okay, thank you, Lester. Again, the focus of this presentation was on chromium modeling and trying to understand the cleanup. I think we've talked a lot about arsenic in the past, and I think the key message for that is that where the arsenic is generated is all within the center of the plume that's contained by it. So there's a very robust monitoring program in place to make sure that those in situ and agricultural byproducts don't get out to any domestic wells, and that's a big part of the environmental impact report and the associated mitigation that was required by the environmental.
What are the levels?
I don't have the levels off the top of my head.
They're
published in documents that are available online.
Keep going.
Okay.
No, Lisa. We're going to keep going. We'll take questions later. We're taking questions later.
Just a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, if you could please fill out a card and bring it up front, and when we're ready to take questions, we'll go ahead and call you up front.
Okay, so now I'd like to start in on what I think is the main topic of the evening as far as the site goes, and that is the monitoring and reporting plan development for the CAO that's scheduled to be issued next year. I've got a couple of introductory slides, and then Margie Gentile, who's been working on this program in detail for a while, has got about a 30-minute presentation. So we're going to go through a lot of data. We've done our best to try to simplify 20,000 data points and get it down into a way that we can explain and kind of get our mind around it. And again, we're happy to dive into as much detail as folks feel are necessary. Next slide. So to try to frame this, we put together a little graphic that we found, even on our team who deals with this every day, we kept getting kind of confusing ourselves with what all the different pieces of the pie were. Now, as Lori showed in her slide, there's three basic goals of the monitoring program. We want to monitor the plume, we want to monitor the cleanup, and we want to ensure that the residents are protected. I mean, we can say that in a lot of different ways, but those are kind of the three big pieces. This part of the pie that's outlined in blue are the pieces that perform those functions, and I'm going to talk about each one in a little bit of detail. Just to be clear and to be complete, what we're not going to talk about tonight are some other sampling programs beyond this one, which include the USGS background study, which we talked a lot about in the past, which is getting underway, and then also a separate thing on a waste pit investigation on a small waste pit to the southwest. Those are kind of separate and aside from this. So what we're going to spend most of our time talking about today is this big piece. There's a lot in that piece. We counted, and one of the reasons this is so confusing, even to people working on the projects, we counted, and there were actually 65 different reports submitted in over the last year, driven by these various reporting, sampling programs, reporting programs, and investigations. Okay, so we've sent 65 different documents in, which is why when you go onto GeoTracker, you find such a broad array of information. And it's all good information that was all developed, kind of organically as individual problems came up. We really think it's time to kind of put our arms around the whole thing and simplify this so that everybody can understand what's going on. Now, importantly also, there's sort of three different layers of protection here that we think have to be looked at holistically. As we've spoken with Water Board staff on this, we've worked on, in fact, there's, I think, general agreement on what an updated IRZ program should look like. But along the way of doing that, we said, we've really got to stop, take a step back, and look at this program in total so that we come up with something that's coherent and logical and defensible. And there's sort of three different layers of protection, if you will, that I want to just sort of paint a picture for you. The first is the standard chromium monitoring. Now, the ATUs and the IRZs have some other things they monitor, but they monitor chromium. And I would suggest that at most sites, this is the kind of information that you see. You see a plume map. At a gasoline station, you'll see a benzene monitoring program. These three pieces together give us a tremendous amount of chromium data that's derived from specifically placed chromium monitoring wells. Okay? So we're going to kind of talk about these three together. At Hinckley, there's a second layer that was added. Because of concerns over public health and concerns as the drinking water standard was being promulgated, there's also a domestic well sampling program where many, many, many domestic wells are sampled. That's in a separate order, but that gives us some other data that's helpful. These two programs what we call the monitoring program, which are the blue shaded ones, and the domestic whales, which are the purple shaded, the data from these are graphically displayed over here. So we've made a couple of different maps, and I'll freely, one could make many more. But what we, when we show this one, it says monitoring wells. That's the blue section in the north part of the site in the shallow zone. That's what that map's about. These are the monitoring wells in the south part of the site in the shallow zone. This map, which covers some of the same, is data from the domestic wells. These are monitoring wells in the deep. And then these two maps show our proposal going forward. Okay, so when we make that domestic versus monitoring well distinction, this is what we're talking about. Lastly, at Hinckley, there's even a third layer of protection, and that is the hydraulic monitoring program. Now, the first two things we talked about measure chromium. The last one measures groundwater flow direction. And there's been a very thorough, robust technical review of how the groundwater flows and where we should monitor it to make sure that the plume isn't flowing away. And so that's a third piece of this that we think needs to be considered as we look at the geometry of all these different pieces. Next one. So we have an extensive data set. So right now, on the monitoring well portion, there's 670 current monitoring wells. Okay, 337 of them were put in for investigation. And when we say investigation, this is when, a few years ago, when we said, we're not sure what's out there. We need to cover a large area and understand on a broad area what the chromium concentrations are like. 337 of them were put in for investigation. The remainder were put in to monitor things like the IRZs and the ATUs. They were built as part of the remedy. From that, we have almost 17,000 individual chromium samples over time and over space from all over this site. So it's a tremendous amount of data that gives us a lot of information about the site. On top of that, then, mostly within the last few years, but some going back beyond that, we've now also added about 400 domestic wells that have been sampled, and we have close to 5,000 results out of those domestic wells. Okay, so there's a tremendous amount of data, over 20,000 data points that we're going to try to condense for you here and tell you what we think we see in that pile of data. It's told us a lot of things about the site. It's told us that groundwater generally changes very slowly. Chemical changes, as you look at most of these curves, you'll see time and again there's flat, fairly steady curves. Where they're larger amplitude, they tend to be at very low levels. It goes from 1 to 2, that sort of thing. We don't see wells going from 2 to 400 and that sort of thing. It also tells us that there's a really big difference between the north and the south. In the south, what we call the core plume area, no question about it, this is chrome that emanated from the compressor station. This is where the tens and the hundreds and, in fact, the thousands of parts per billion of chrome are. Very clear footprint of that. In the north, much more ambiguous, much more diffuse concentrations, much lower concentrations in the north. So, again, as we look at this, we'll have extensive discussions over what the north means, but there's no denying that the north and the south are different. And importantly, the other thing that this data has shown us is that with over 5,000 samples, all of the domestic wells are below the drinking water standard, the MCL of 10. And in fact, 95% of them are below the current background level of 3.1. So again, it's important to make that break between what we understand about where the plume is, very clear, it's been the focus of the CAOs, the focus of the remediation, and then what we're seeing in the domestic wells, which is much, much, much lower. Okay, next one. So we're in a transition phase. As we say, we're changing from discovery to interpretation. Okay, we put a lot of wells in to discover what was out there. We've seen that. We've monitored it. We're now moving into interpretation. There are questions in the data. Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of interesting ones that we'll point out that still have us scratching our heads, that Dr. Izbicki's looking at, that we're looking at with Water Board staff, with the TWG. But the vast majority of the data seems to be holding steady. We want to shift the focus on to groundwater remediation. It's time to do that. Some of the current orders have already done that. We need to continue to build on that. And then importantly, right now we count 34 orders and letters, like I said, 65 reports. In the interest of transparency and just getting a coherent picture of the site out there, we think it's time to really narrow those down, consolidate them, and get all the right information into a smaller number of reports that could be reviewed. We've tried to do that. We've looked at things holistically. We've tried to come up with consolidated requirements, and we want to try to unify the reporting. So that's an overview of what we've done, what we tried to do. I'm now going to turn it over to Margie Gentile, who's going to walk through the individual. She's going to walk around those pieces of the pie and kind of talk program by program over where we've been and where we're proposing to go.
Thanks for the introduction and the opportunity to talk about this today. But Kevin did a good job talking through the different pieces of the monitoring program, but just in case you didn't catch it, I'm going to go through it one more time, the three different pieces of the monitoring program we're talking about, and show it visually on the map, if you can go to the next slide. So zooming in and to the next slide, the first component of the monitoring program is the groundwater monitoring. So this is the network of monitoring wells where samples are collected to look at water quality in the aquifer. It's a little hard to see here, but there's the blue dots that kind of showed up on the map here are all of the monitoring wells in this network, in this particular area. And then the second component, moving to the next slide, is the domestic well sampling program. So you can see the green dots that showed up in the vicinity of the plume. And so this is where samples are collected to look at water quality in the domestic wells themselves. And then the third piece of the puzzle that Kevin already talked about, or next slide, is the hydraulic capture monitoring program. So this is where we're looking at water levels to understand where groundwater is flowing and to make sure that the core chromium plume is contained. And so next slide. Together, all three of these programs provide a really robust monitoring network that allows us to understand where the chromium exists, where it exists in relation to the domestic wells, and how the remediation is working. So I'm going to step through each of these components of the monitoring program and provide our technical recommendations for how these programs can be structured in the new cleanup and abatement order. So how do we go about looking at the monitoring programs and coming up with a technical recommendation for what should be monitored moving forward? Well, we looked at a lot of the existing site data. So next slide. Kevin already pointed out some of the maps that are around the room that have a lot of data posted on them, and the data is posted in the format of these concentration time graphs. So I'm going to take just a second to explain what these graphs show. So all of these black diamonds are individual chromium concentration data points from a given monitoring location. So each graph represents a particular monitoring location. Those are shown versus time on the x-axis, and that axis is shown in years. Different monitoring locations have the different number of years of data depending upon when they were installed. And then we're showing the chromium concentration on the y-axis. Each of these graphs also has a blue line. That is the current maximum background concentration of 3.1. So that just gives you a visual clue if you kind of can see the lines going across these, or as we put them up on the screen here, of a reference point of 3.1 parts per billion.
Maybe Kevin could go and point over on the big maps where people could see that graph on the, I mean.
That particular graph I have shown later on where it's from, and I have a couple of those.
It's on.
It'd be hard to point out. I have it on a later graph exactly where that one's from.
Just along this side.
Where they can find it. On.
So these are the different monitoring wells, and I think we picked one that's got some, there's one with some wiggle in it, okay? okay.
Yeah, that's not the same one. But
it's
that,
not.
That's right.
I'm sorry, you're looking specifically...
Yeah, where they can find...
I think it's located, like, right here, perhaps, but just, I have it on another slide. It might be that one, the fourth one from the top.
There it is.
That's okay. 103.
Thanks. I mean, it's variation in this graph, but...
To be honest, I mean, these are... I know that you put a lot of time into preparing these graphs, but nobody there can see all the dots on... I mean...
Definitely not. So we'll go through and explain some of the trends we're seeing.
Right. I'm just suggesting that, you know, we go through... Take our time, go through this, and that also people know that there'll be time to go and look at the big maps over here where they can see this more easily than they can see it on the PowerPoint.
Okay. Agreed, yeah. That would be great. So I'm going to provide the general concepts and trends we're seeing, and then you can go see the data for yourself, as Dr. Horn is saying, when we're talking. Okay, so we can go to the next slide. Using all of the data that exists, about almost 17,000 monitoring well results, and almost 5,000 domestic well results, we have a lot of information about where chromium exists and where it doesn't exist, where concentrations are consistent over time, and where things are changing, like the location that Kevin just pointed out over there, that are important to watch. And we also know where the background study is going to be occurring. And then finally, we know a lot about the site hydrogeology from the investigations that have been occurring in the past couple of years. We know what the aquifer looks like, where the chromium resides within that aquifer, and where the groundwater is flowing. And so all of this information was used to develop our recommendations for how to sample moving forward under the new CAO. So with that, I'm going to step through each of these programs. Next slide. Starting with the groundwater monitoring program. So again, that's the sort of blue pieces, the monitoring well sampling program. So next slide. We've already talked about the objectives for groundwater monitoring, and there are a few. So the first was really to evaluate how the remedy is working. So this is the agricultural treatment unit, the in-situ remediation, freshwater injection. How well is that working? It's one of the main objectives of sampling monitoring wells. And then the other major objective is to track the chromium plume. And we've divided that into two different areas, the contiguous plume boundary and the northern area. And I'll talk about each of those. So first looking at the remedy performance on the next slide. So we're zooming in here to the southern portion of the site where the contiguous plume from the compressor station source down here in the south is located. And this is the area where active remediation is occurring. So there's agricultural treatment units being operated, there's in-situ remediation, there's freshwater injection. There's a network of monitoring wells that are being sampled for looking at remediation in this area. And this is to look at remediation effectiveness, to understand if it's working, how to improve remediation, and also to monitor any byproducts that are generated and to track them. So I think a couple people mentioned that the specifics of these monitoring programs for remediation throughout this area are already contained in a number of orders. So for the agricultural treatment unit, there's waste discharge requirements and some notice of applicability against those WDRs that were adopted earlier this year to specify that monitoring. And then for the in-situ reactive zone, there's a number of orders that specify the monitoring requirements that have come along since 2008. And we've also been looking at streamlining some of that monitoring in this in-situ area. And the Water Board staff proposed a revised program in a letter that came out in February. So there's already been a lot of thought and establishment of this monitoring network, and there's quite a robust network of wells that are sampled at various frequencies to look at the effectiveness of remediation and byproducts of remediation. So then zooming out from this area on the next slide to the whole site, we can use that as a foundation and build on it. This is the area we were just looking at, and looking to the whole site and chromium throughout the site, that's the other objective of groundwater monitoring, is to really track the chromium. And so in looking at recommendations for structuring a program in the CIO for chromium monitoring, the site sort of naturally splits itself into two areas, the southern area and then the northern area. So if you can click forward once. So in the southern area, this is where the contiguous plume from the compressor station is located. I think Kevin talked about this in his introduction. This is where the chromium concentrations are very elevated, up to milligram per liter levels. The chromium in this area also is situated within different aquifer units. So it's got a depth component to it that needs to be considered in structuring a monitoring program to make sure that we're capturing the plume at all the various portions of the aquifer system. And then this is also the area where active remediation is going to be occurring, so where things will be changing. We'll expect chromium to be remediated. We'll also have actively changing groundwater flow conditions. And so we're recommending a certain style program for the southern area with frequent plume delineation and on a quarterly basis, and sampling of wells to delineate the plume on that basis, and also a network that's described in each of the aquifer units to look at that chromium plume. And then in the northern area, if you can click again, chromium has also been found through investigations to be present in groundwater above the 3.1 current maximum background level in this area, and also in some locations above 10 parts per billion. But in this area, it's present in a thinner portion of the aquifer, the most shallow portion of the aquifer. And so we're recommending sampling with a frequency that's based on the data trends that are observed in this area, and with some specifics related to it being located in just this one aquifer unit. So I'm going to talk about each of these in a little bit more detail in the next two slides. So first, starting with the southern portion. So this is where, next slide. We're recommending quarterly sampling of wells to really define and bound the chromium plume. So for example, we're looking here at the shallow unit of the upper aquifer. So this is this map, this first map that's shown over at the right. And if you see the orange dots on this map, those are the wells we're recommending for quarterly sampling to bound the plume in this aquifer unit. We have a similar program set up for the deep portion. This is the fourth map over here. You can see the chromium plume. It's difficult to see, but when you go look at it up close, the chromium plume in that aquifer unit is a different shape and size, and we specified a different set of orange wells for quarterly sampling to bound the plume in that aquifer unit. There's also a lower aquifer here. We didn't bring that map, but again, it's recommending quarterly sampling of a network of wells in that aquifer unit to define the plume. So we're not recommending sampling for wells that are upgradient of the plume, cross-gradient, or stable in concentration. So that means that wells out to the east and southeast or the west of the plume would no longer be in the sampling program. And so all of these plots that are on this map here that's shown on the sidewall, and again for the other aquifer unit, support this recommendation to not sample these locations. So I'm going to show two specific examples. These are just examples, but they are representative of what we're seeing throughout the area. If you can click. And in this case, I actually showed where the wells are located. And again, you can see that the concentrations for wells that we're recommending not to sample are outside the plume, so they're less than 3.1 in concentration. And what we're seeing in a lot of this data is that it's very consistent over time. So we're seeing the same kind of behavior that gives us comfort that we know what's going on in these areas. That's for the southern portion of the plume. In the northern area, the next slide, is a little bit different. So there's some other characteristics of this area. When the investigation was conducted in this area, for every monitoring well location that was installed, there was a cluster of a couple of wells, two to three wells, that were installed at different depths within the same aquifer unit, this shallow aquifer unit that contains the chromium. And that's how you go about doing an investigation. You want to understand how wide and how long the plume or chromium, the extent of chromium is, but and also how deep it is and where it resides within the aquifer. So we've gotten a lot of data from these monitoring locations, and shown on the screen are three example data sets from these wells. And so each of these graphs shows an individual location, and then the data trends, the multiple data trends on each of these graphs show the different depths within that given location. And so you can see that there's a couple of different behaviors of the chromium concentration trends at different locations. A lot of the locations look like the top two graphs, where the concentrations are fairly consistent over time and steady. And then we see a couple of locations stand out. This is this map over here, the second one. So we can see that a lot of the trend graphs, as we scroll through, look very constant over time, but some really stand out as being dynamic, like this location here that's being shown on the bottom here, and this location here. So in looking at this, we really think it's important to watch the locations that are variable and that are dynamic. Can you click the next slide? And to sample those on a quarterly basis. For locations that are a lot more consistent over time in concentration, we're suggesting a semi-annual sampling frequency, which will be sufficient to capture the data that's occurring at those locations. And then with depth, we're recommending sampling of the green highlighted intervals that we have on the map that are shown on this slide. Those are the sort of the most informative concentration trend out of a given cluster of monitoring wells. And click one more time. And then not sampling the other depths at a given monitoring location. So in some cases, those depths have just much less chromium, and chromium less than 3.1. And in other cases, the concentrations are just very consistent with one another between the different sampling depths. So those are the recommendations for the chromium monitoring throughout the site from the groundwater monitoring network. Next, I'm going to move on to the domestic well sampling program. Next slide. So the current domestic well sampling program was initiated in 2011, and that's at a time when there was a lot of concern over what concentration of chromium might be in domestic wells, and there wasn't very much data. There also wasn't a maximum contaminant limit for MCL for hex chrome at that time. So since implementing this program, there's been a lot of data generated, over 5,000 data points, and that's really as a result of community members being willing to provide access for sampling from their domestic wells and allow their time to be disturbed and coordinating collection of those samples. So from the several years of data that have been collected and the almost 5,000 data points, as Kevin mentioned, we now know that all the domestic wells in the area are less than the MCL of 10 parts per billion, and that greater than 95% of them are also well below the current background level of 3.1. So the new CAO will specify domestic well sampling, so we can start to think about how domestic wells should be sampled for a couple purposes. We want to make sure that the remediation isn't impacting the chromium concentration in domestic wells. We also want to make sure any domestic wells that have some elevated concentrations don't increase any further. Next slide. And the domestic well program is, you know, as we talked in the beginning, really part of a three-prong approach to monitoring and knowing where the chromium plume is. So it's done in concert with groundwater monitoring and the hydraulic capture monitoring. So I'm going to talk about our recommendations for the domestic well sampling program in three different areas and walk through each of those areas. So the first area, next slide, is the area in the south where the southern plume resides. And this is the area where active remediation is occurring. So the environmental impact report that was adopted last year specifies mitigation for remediation to protect domestic wells. And that includes requirements for domestic well sampling. And those requirements were adopted in the ATU-WDRs earlier this year. And the requirement is that within this sampling area around the flume that's being remediated, domestic well sampling be conducted quarterly or at some approved program. So the reason for conducting this sampling is to make sure that what's going on in the active remediation area isn't changing things in domestic wells in the vicinity. This is really protective, and we don't expect this to happen because the majority of what we're doing for remediation, you know, one of the main things we're doing for remediation is installing extraction wells within the plume and operating them, which is to pull the plume towards the extraction well. So it's really to pull the plume in and away from domestic wells. So when we think about where is it important to really sample or sample frequently to protect domestic wells, we thought about, well, what's going to be changing in the next year in terms of remediation and groundwater flow conditions? And what's going to be changing is the installation of some new agricultural units and some increased pumping in the southern part of the site. So we used a groundwater model to look at where that might significantly change groundwater flow conditions. If you can click down. Just click down one. And the model is indicating that within this orange area, groundwater flow conditions will be changing. So we think it's important to sample within this area. There are some domestic wells here right around the plume on a quarterly sampling frequency. Outside of that area, domestic wells are located in two different places. Either they're near remedial systems like the agricultural units that have been operating for a couple years, and we have data from a couple of years, so we know what happens to chromium concentrations in those domestic wells. And then there's also domestic wells that are located very far away from the remedial system, where we don't expect the operation of the system to have an impact. And so in this area, outside the orange area, we have some recommendations. First, we're recommending that if a domestic well has a chromium concentration that is currently above 3.1 parts per billion, that continue to be sampled on a frequent quarterly basis. And there's one well, this well right here with an orange halo, that meets that condition. All the rest of the wells in this area are less than 3.1 parts per billion, and we recommend sampling those on a semi-annual frequency. And then for this, we have another recommendation for this area that's to the northwest. This is where there's a very high density of domestic wells, and it's not in the direction where the groundwater is flowing from the plume. So we're recommending a sentry monitoring well network, so that's these purple dots located here, to verify that the plume is not migrating towards this neighborhood of domestic wells. So sampling those monitoring wells will give an early warning for if there are any changes in the plume, and would be done in lieu of monitoring these domestic wells to minimize the disturbance to those homeowners in this high-density neighborhood. So those are... similar to looking at the monitoring network, we also looked at the data from these domestic wells. And you click the next slide. The data is shown here on this third panel. And you know, this is just a snapshot to say that there is a panel, not that anyone's supposed to be able to see on the screen. If you click to the next slide, are two example graphs. And again, these are just example representative graphs, but you can look at all the data for yourself. So these are the graphs from the wells that we're recommending for semi-annual sampling frequency. And you can see that a lot of this data is very consistent over time, and so would be well characterized by a semi-annual sampling frequency that we're recommending. That was the first area for domestic wells. Let's move on to the second area, which is the northern area. Next slide. In this northern area, the chromium concentrations, you can see the plume here at the 3.1, and then some areas of 10 parts per billion. And we talked about the trends in this area all being relatively stable throughout the area. So this is also the area where the background study is being conducted. And there are domestic wells with concentration between 3.1 and 5 parts per billion. So while the background study is being conducted, we think it's important to continue to track the chromium in these domestic wells. And we're recommending to do so on an annual sampling frequency for wells that are above 3.1, or if they're near, like within 2,000 feet of a monitoring well that is above 10 parts per billion. And then the final area is on the next slide, are the areas shown here with the orange circles and the arrows that are cross-gradient and up-gradient of the compressor station. So these are areas where the chromium in groundwater is clearly not sourced from the compressor station. And we're not recommending sampling of domestic wells in these areas. And this is consistent with previous technical determinations from the Water Board on these areas. So that wraps up the recommendations for the domestic well sampling program. And then the last piece of the monitoring program I'm going to talk about is a slightly different in character. We're not going to talk about chemistry and frequency as much. We're going to talk about hydraulic capture monitoring. So this is the program that looks at water levels and groundwater flow to make sure the plume is being captured. So skip to the next slide, and then the next slide. So the way that hydraulic capture is measured is through the establishment of capture metrics. And this is the current capture line that was established based on data from 2011 and was put in order in 2012. Next slide. And so there's a specific network of monitoring wells where water level data is collected to show that groundwater is flowing from outside the boundary to inside the boundary. And that's been demonstrated according to these metrics that were established on a monthly basis since the order came out in 2012. And the way it's achieved is through operating the extraction system. And these red dots just show in a pictorial sense where the pumping centers that we're currently operating are located to achieve this capture across the boundary. So if we skip forward to 2014 and look at the plume, next slide, we can see that this has been a successful implementation. So we see, if you kind of flip back and forth between the previous one and this one, that the 3.1 and the 10 parts per billion plume have shrunk. And currently, our extraction wells are located in some low concentration areas where the plume has cleaned up. So it's time in the project to reconfigure our extraction system and to optimize it for the current conditions. This is part of adaptive operations that we talked about a lot at the last meeting. So that requires some updates to the capture metric. And then an additional reason for updating the capture metric on the next slide. This is a potential reconfiguration of the system where we may increase and concentrate our pumping to the south in the high concentration and we would be pulling the chromium back and then reconfigure how we're doing pumping in the north. So a second reason for doing this, if you flip to the next slide, is because our current extraction configuration and how we're pumping in the shallow unit that I just showed is having a negative impact on the plume in the deep. So you can see how the plume looked in 2011, and with our current pumping configuration, it's getting tugged a little bit to the east. So if you can flip to the previous slide. Yeah. So this reconfiguration will also help with that issue. So we've proposed to the Water Board staff a pump test to test out this proposed reconfiguration and see how it works. And you really need to change your pumping and then have it on for a little while to see if it's working. And if it is successful, we would want to redesign the capture metric based on that. So our pump test will also give us information for that redesign. So we proposed to conduct a test this winter from December to February, a 3-month test. And during that time, we may some of the capture metrics that are currently in place may not pass. We have to kind of talk about how that works regulatorily to be able to complete this test and get to a more optimal remedial system. So what does all this mean for the CAO? So you can go down 2 slides. Our recommendation for the CAO is that the hydraulic capture metric be structured in a flexible way. So the CAO itself may contain how the capture metrics generally should be structured, or some description of the requirements, but the details of where the line is drawn and which monitoring wells are used to collect the data may be contained outside in a separately approved plan that can be easily changed over time and approved over time to keep up with the changes in remediation. So that completes the third piece. And I think it's time for other questions, or is there another order next?
Yeah, so I just wanted to wrap up. There was a lot of info. we tried to do it in as organized a way as we could with the pie pieces. As you go to look at the data over there, again, your eye will go to the outliers, the unusual ones. I'd encourage you to look at the density of data, and that's really what we're trying to capitalize on. I mean, right now, we're literally spending millions and millions of dollars a year to gather this data, and we think that it's a good time to evolve it. The project is changing. We're out of the discovery stage. We're into the interpretation stage. I want to emphasize we're not getting rid of any wells. That's it. We're not in none of these proposals. When we say stop sampling, we're saying leave the well there. If something changes, we can always go back to it. But we're not talking about removing any of these wells as part of this proposal.
Okay, we're
going to
try something here to see if we can make sense of all of this information. So before we open it up to questions, I want to ask Laurie Kimber to come back up here and pose questions, probably to Kevin, to see if we can kind of get the big picture of what's going on.
Okay. Dr. Horn asked me to try to recap what Margie presented because it was a lot of information. So her focus, what we want to try to do is do a recap or summarize what are the kind of key differences that PG&E is proposing in terms of the monitoring program. So, and by the way, I want to point out too that this is PG&E's proposal right now, and the prosecution team and Lisa and myself will be looking at all of this data in detail, and we may or may not agree with some of the proposals, but tonight we're trying to get input on the general approach that PG&E has laid out. So in terms of the chromium monitoring, the north areas versus the main plume boundaries, what I heard Marty say is that for the main plume, the core area that is located from the compressor station to about Thompson Road, PG&E is essentially going to continue to monitor the majority of those monitoring wells on a quarterly basis. They're going to continue the quarterly monitoring program for the main plume. There may be some wells in that area, certain depths that might be eliminated, but in general, that program will be kind of the same. Is that true, Kevin? Is that in your proposal?
Right. Let me...
So that's one of the changes that PG&E is proposing, that in that area surrounding the core part of the plume, they would be no longer monitoring wells that are clearly up gradient, cross gradient, or where there's very stable non-hex or very low concentrations of chrome that have been stable over time that haven't changed. Those wells would be eliminated. Those are located outside of the 3.1 plume boundary for the main core.
Sorry, Laura, I'm just trying to get a graph. All right, so I think this is helpful, right? So on the monitoring program, the chromium, right, so we're starting with places that I believe we've discussed at length with Water Board staff. The ATU in the southern area is the same. No changes there. The IRZ program, which has not been officially changed, but there's the letter from February. We had a lot of technical discussion about that. No changes to that. So we took those two pieces as sort of the beginning.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that monitoring is down where things are going to be changing. Then your question is this last piece, and I would agree with that characterization, that the basic idea is let's look at the outline of the plume and let's watch that quarterly. Where we have wells that are either well inside or well outside. Those are the ones where we've looked at data trends and said, let's change that.
And then in the northern areas, that's where Margie talked about looking again at kind of the data in the north, and potentially for some of those wells where it's more stable, that you would propose semi-annual frequency. But for some of those that have a lot of variability, you continue to monitor those monitoring wells quarterly. And for both of these areas, we're talking about the monitoring well network, not the wells.
Right. So the way I would kind of simple, the way I think about the north is that we went up there, we were in discovery. At every point, we put in three different wells. And when you go and look at this map, let your eye follow. There's three different lines. One's a shallow, one's a medium, and one's a depth. I'd suggest this is the kind of pattern you typically see. And we're saying, let's monitor the worst one. Let's look at the one that is the highest trend, or that's behaving strangely. In this one, we're saying, this is the one that matters. We went out there, we put three in, we've watched them for a long time. We now know which is the problem child. Let's keep monitoring that one. We don't need to monitor that one. So this is
the three, are they at different?
Yes, they're different. So the map shows a shallow one, shallow
and
two. Shallow.
The green one isn't necessarily the shallow layer. It
no.
might be. So we don't know what levels those are. Those aren't labeled.
There's labels on them.
You have to look at the S and the D.
The reason you were given foldouts is they're helpful to pull out. You can actually
right.
read them.
And I'll
but I don't have them folded out right now.
Right. And I'll suggest that when you look at it, there's if you just eyeball this chart, you'll see most of the lines, they're all pretty flat. There are, you know, again, there are some that are unusual. I mean, that's the one we put on the slide here. And there's another judgment there that we asked ourselves, sort of, how stable does this look? That's not stable. We don't understand what's happening. This well has been the topic of a lot of discussion. We want to focus this monitoring on things that we still don't understand. We see steady patterns here. And so in this cluster, this highest well, we'll say we'll keep watching that, but we'll do it semi-annual. These other two deeper ones, we won't sample, because we think we've looked at this enough and that we understand that's the one that's the challenge. Because this is such a large area, and again, I think when you go to look at it, what you'll see is that the vast majority of these are low and steady. They're in the 1, 2, 3, 5 part per billion range, and they're very, very steady. We don't see, it's not like in the south, where we know a couple hundred feet away there's 1,000 parts per billion. We don't have that situation up in the north. And where we have variability, we put a, we think, a protective layer in the domestic well that we'll talk about.
Okay, yeah, now domestic well.
Right.
So what's different about domestic well program is essentially some of the domestic wells are being sampled as part of the ATU requirements, where there's a certain distance from where the agricultural treatment units are. So that's how those wells are dictated for monitoring. And then for other domestic wells, PG&E is proposing to no longer monitor them, but use a century well approach. So that area there in the purple, that's where we have a high concentration of Hinckley residents that live behind the Hinckley Elementary School. Rather than sample everybody's well quarterly, as they're now doing, PG&E would sample monitoring wells that are kind of between the plume, between those yellow lines and the century zone, to monitor whether chromium is increasing as it's moving toward that area, so sort of ahead of time. And so that eliminates a larger number of some of your domestic wells that you're doing right now.
Right. So there's maybe...
Yeah, what's different?
So, yeah, but,
focus on
the, you know, the quarterly area, that's the same. And, Frank, there's a very small number of wells in that quarterly area. This semi-annual area is really what this map is all about. These are all the wells that we're proposing to take from quarterly to semi-annual. And I'll ask you, go up and look at these lines and where they are relative to the blue 3.1 line. I mean, they're flat. These are not changing significantly, and so we feel that the technical data justifies a change from quarterly sampling to semi-annual sampling. It's less intrusive on the homeowners. It's less impactful. And we think that this mass of data shows that we understand that these are steady. And then, Lori, the last bit is we looked at this area. This is the downtown area north of the school. And that's where we said, number one, we've got very low concentrations there. Number two, we know that we're monitoring the hydraulic capture here and that this plume is not migrating this way. Three, let's put in a sentry well network that would sort of serve as an early warning system for that area. Because, again, it seemed like a large number of residents that would be in there, you know, sampling repeatedly in a very dense area that technically that data doesn't really add much to the overall set.
So, Kevin, it's figure 5 in the agenda packet, and there is a copy in the back of the room, at least one, if not more. But it has a domestic well sampling program, and it shows the light blue colors, the semi-annual frequency, and the clear circles of domestic wells that are not going to be sampled in the future.
Right. So,
I mean, some of those are the century, but some of those are like on Mountain View Road, too. So.
Right, so these are the ones in the sentry, and then the other point that Margie made is that wells outside east of Dixie and up gradient are those we're proposing to remove from the from the program.
There's also wells north along Mountain View, like these areas here.
Outside the main one?
Yeah, well, they're outside the ATU mitigation, but like along here. They're not quite in the sentry zone, but they're just kind of.
Probably fall under
what
we're proposing to move.
Right. So
the well,
so you're going to have to talk to the whole room.
Yeah. Sorry.
Those are the wells that we turned in the northern area. So that circle that we're looking at, remember this, that circle was defined by the remediation. We took any place where we were changing the water significantly because of the remediation, and we drew a big circle around it. And so we're calling for that's the south, you know, and that's the area that the EIR was prescriptive about. Thou shalt, this is the place that the technical analysis says domestic wells might change. We need to watch that. So that's that program. If it's north of that circle, we're terming that the northern area, and that's the other discussion.
Is that because so the domestic wells? I was just confused because the domestic wells that are shown as clear circles, I'm assuming aren't getting sampled in any program, and that I know that we're using domestic wells in the north in some cases to delineate the flow because we don't have monitoring well data there. So those domestic wells are being sampled, but it appears that in Figure 5 there's a number of domestic wells that are being eliminated in the northern area.
Right. So in the north, again, what we see in the north is a large area of very diffuse concentrations. You know, this is the area that needs studying in the background. Some's below 3.1, some's at 4, some's at 5. None is at 10. Okay, none of the domestic wells are at 10. But we said, that's what we want to be protective of. So we said, let's be safe. If we get a monitor, there are some monitoring wells doing funny things up there. And that becomes, that's our risk area. We see a monitoring well, we say, let's draw a 2,000-foot circle around it. And anybody within that, we're saying they might be close to a place that's got higher levels of chrome. Let's be extra careful on that. Let's monitor that. And let's keep sampling any wells that are above 3.1.
All right. Okay. And then lastly, I just want to reiterate, it's not really a question for Kevin as much as it's for people in the room. Margie talked about the hydraulic capture and how Water Board staff and PG&E staff recognize that moving ahead in the new cleanup order, we're going to have to get creative about a flexible requirement that can be adjusted over time as the plume shrinks. PG&E has put a request in writing to us that they want to perform these tests during the period from December to February, and during that time they may not comply with the current cleanup order. And they've asked for some type of abeyance, which essentially means they don't want the Water Board to take enforcement action for any increases in chromium or groundwater direction changes that would violate the current cleanup order. And I would recommend that that Lori Kemper, me, the chief of the prosecution team, send a letter to PG&E saying that for that period of time, three months testing period of 86 months of reporting, that I wouldn't recommend taking enforcement actions on any minor changes in chromium. The other thing, that if there were increases in chromium during this test period, we required PG&E to submit a contingency plan. We just received that plan this last week, so we can share it with the Community Advisory Committee and with Dr. Webster. But that would require, they have to do maybe increased monitoring potentially during this test period, so that if they see any changes, they could immediately take corrective action, turn pumps on or off, or adjust how they're doing their remediation. So that is also kind of a specific question on the table that wasn't on any of the slides earlier today.
All right. Okay, what we're going to do now, you mentioned that there's going to be a CAC meeting that's going to be focused on this question, and when and where will that be?
Actually, the next Community Advisory Committee meeting is scheduled for November 20th, and Dr. Webster can talk, and maybe Darren Banks and other CAC members can talk about what's on that agenda. It's not specifically focused on this, other than there is an item to do a recap of the water board meeting, and this will be an opportunity for the community to ask Dr. Webster questions about this material, because he's got copies of it all as well. So they can provide input to Dr. Webster, and he can submit it to us, or you can send it directly to us.
Thank you. Okay, so we have another 25 minutes on this item, and I think what I'll propose now is it will take a few questions. This is going to be board members' opportunities to ask questions. But whatever time we have left over to break, and people can go over and look at these maps and ask questions. PG&E people can stand over there and answer questions. We'll just use the rest of the time until 9 o'clock that way for more informal dialogue about the monitoring program, and then we'll start item 9 at 9 o'clock. So, Esther, you have a couple of questions. Anybody else have questions to ask? Write your question down. We can pick up your questions. Board members, think of your questions, and we'll do a few questions for them.
So if you have a question when I call your name, please come up to the podium, introduce yourself, and go ahead and ask your question. First, I have Larry Reed, and I apologize if I mispronounce your name.
My name is Larry Greep, president of Hinckley, also on the CAT committee. My views and what I say to you is not pertaining to the CAT committee, because there's always differences of opinion. As I was saying, there's always different views and different opinions as to what we can or shouldn't say as far as the CAT committee is concerned. So this is my personal questions. What I'd like to say about the monitoring, due to the drought and the low water table, I think has kind of hindered this situation greatly. I think there should have been a lot more monitoring wells farther to the west, as there's people out towards where the bar, a few miles to the west, are getting up closer to the 3.1 in chrome. I think something should have been done about that. And also, when you come to the monitoring and stuff like that, the arsenic and the manganese should have been in there all along. They've known about this for a long time. It's been over a year ago where I stressed my opinion as far as having arsenic and manganese in my well, which is located a couple blocks north of community on Sarah Road, across from the real estate office of PG&E. I've had it tested myself. I still have way above the state level of arsenic and manganese. Okay, I've mentioned it to Lori, mentioned it to Kevin. It kind of goes like deaf ears, because you would think arsenic would be something the State Water Board would want to protect the people from. But it seems like money overpowers or egos. There's something here that has stopped this arsenic from being checked on. So they say, well, it was already there. Well, if you have something that's laying dormant, and I come over and I stir your bathtub up because I want to clean it, who's responsible for the mess I made? Good question. Well, it don't seem to be, because there's nothing done about it, and I haven't seen any agendas, know nothing about the arsenic and the manganese. That should be part of the monitoring and part of the cleanup. Because I can ask all you people, would you sooner drink 40, 50 parts per billion of arsenic, or would you sooner drink a little chrome 6? So I think that's a very serious issue, and it should be on part of the agenda for this monitoring and for the cleanup. As far as the cleanup, I think this irrigation stuff's caused like kind of a problem. And when you have all the puddling, the pooling, and when you have your excess chrome 6 that's supposed to turn to chrome 3 and it doesn't, it's going to soak in the ground. We haven't had a lot of rain, but when you do get rain and when it does soak in and it soaks in, you're going to have pooling of this water below the ground table. And then when you have that, just be like a big cesspool of chrome 6 just sitting there waiting to get into the water table in the future. So really, a lot of this cleanup, I think, they're diluting it, spreading around, and now you get the potential hazard of a lot of this that is being put above ground of coming back into our water table.
Thank you. Next, I have Darren Bates, please.
Good evening. Dan Banks, Hinkley resident. I guess my first question with Kevin is if you can explain a little bit more to me when you talked about the bio above ground treatment in the diagram, your diagram showed where you were trying to explain where the ag units were basically the same as the above ground, and you have fresh water being put in up gradient and then flowing to the water being pumped up to the agricultural units that are supposed to be cleaning the chromium 6. So you're diluting the chromium 6 water before it goes up to the ag units to be cleaned to the chromium 6. And so, and then the fresh water that's being pumped more to the north, the old saying, you know, the solution to pollution is dilution, and that's what's happening to, you know, much of the chromium 6, or at least in the smaller levels, because it's shameful and inappropriate to think the PG&E's chromium 6 doesn't exist below 3.1, and this number keeps being pushed out there. That's the number that the Water Board is supposed to be enforcing, although there's wells, domestic wells above 3.1 in the Hinkley Valley that are not part of the plume for some reason. But we don't know what that number is going to look like after Dr. Izbicki does his research and his study. And so I don't know if you could explain that to me first. It doesn't make sense to me why you're pumping fresh water in and then pumping it back to the surface when you're supposed to be, the ag units are supposed to be. Can you explain that? I don't understand that.
So this graph was intended to focus on the box. We were trying to simplify this to talk about how the bioreactor works in the box. What this doesn't show very well is in this area is where we have to imagine where the chromium plume is, right? And so the way the pump and treat system works is that you push water through the plume, and it's just like wringing out a sponge. You push the water through, the dirty water comes out, you pump that dirty water up, you clean it, you put clean water back down, and you keep flowing water through that sponge trying to get all of the, you know, all the soap out or all the chrome out. So that's, you know, the idea here is that you inject on one side or one edge of the plume, and then you pump out of the other side or the middle of the plume. That's the way we do it. We pump on the middle, we inject on the edge, and that helps to push water through the plume and desorb, get all the chrome that's stuck to the soil, kind of wash it off. The ag units kind of do the same thing with the fresh water. We pump the water out, that takes the chrome out, the chrome is treated here, a little bit of the water comes back, and then there's additional water
flushing and freshwater injection. My point in this slide wasn't, and I apologize because it wasn't designed to, the slide was not designed to answer the question that you're asking. We were just trying to point out that these two mechanisms are fairly similar. Is that helpful?
Sure.
I can let Ian take a shot.
As far as the cleanup and abatement order, the cleanup and abatement order, first of all, needs to protect public health. And the MCL has nothing to do with the cleanup. You know, the cleanup needs to, first of all, we need to make sure that in the northern areas, in the outlying areas, when that chromium 6 is identified, because it's going to be extremely confusing. We're going to have areas where there's a possibility of having a mix, part PG&Es, part natural. Hopefully, Dr. Izbicki will be able to tell the difference. And so, and we need to be careful not to, we need to, that data, the one thing that I've learned in the last 4 years, the data is vital, it's important. And so, prior to not collecting any data, a discussion needs to be had with Dr. Izbicki before any ruling is made on this, because there's a good possibility that that data will be used in the background study. So we need to be responsible in the decisions that we make of what PG&E is asking. And the reality of it is that PG&E's chromium 6 does exist below 3.1, and hopefully that will be found, which means all of these areas that they like to exclude or not take responsibility for, they are. And it's the board's responsibility to ensure that they clean that up. So in order to do that, we need to continue with the monitoring so we know that we're in the right spot. We spent how many years now getting to this point? Let's not screw it up now. The final point that I'd like to make is that we don't know exactly the amount that was put in there, volume in, volume out. So to put a number on a cleanup and abatement order until we're more confident in how much chromium 6 PG&E does need to come out and where their levels are, where their chromium 6 exists, is again irresponsible. A lot of these answers we have to wait. And a lot of things that they want to do, we have to wait. And I think that the order needs to make sure and reflect that, especially in the outlying areas, the east, the west, and the northern part, where they don't like to concede responsibility for it. Because I think we're going to find they are responsible for a lot of it. And that's all I have. Thanks.
Were there any board members that had any questions?
Sure.
Well, I have a question, and I'm Kim Niemeyer, and it's more just maybe for Lori just to clarify. So the question's about the arsenic and the manganese. So will that monitoring be addressed in this order, or would that be addressed in the order for the IRZ?
The current permit for the IRZs requires arsenic and manganese monitoring. And there's also the agricultural treatment requirements also require that, as well as uranium monitoring. So that monitoring is required under those orders. So that's why we didn't talk about it tonight, Larry, because it's in those other orders. The focus was on what we were going to put in this new permit.
So the new cleanup and abatement order isn't going to address those?
No. I mean, it'll mention it just because we want the cleanup order to kind of be an umbrella so people understand what is required of PG&E, so PG&E understands what's required of them, but to be able to lay out that kind of monitoring is in these other orders, and then the cleanup order will lay out specific additional monitoring.
So then, just to clarify then, there's essentially three orders that address the remediation. One's the Agricultural Treatment Unit, WDRs, that were adopted recently. Then we have an existing order for the IRZ, which is the in-situ treatment. And then we're going to have the current cleanup and abatement order, that's the new cleanup order that will be next year that will specifically address chromium. So there's three different orders. So I don't think that was necessarily clear for people.
And, you know, I think obviously the other thing is that we're consolidating the 23 or 65, you know, the 23 separate orders that exist today that require PG&E to do different investigations and monitoring. We're going to try to get all of that into the new clean order. It looks like Larry has another question. You want to come up, Larry?
That's good.
Do you want to take? I know Dr. Horn would like us to take a break so that people can ask PG&E and other folks questions with the maps, you know, to look at those in detail so people can get questions answered about specific locations.
Yeah. Ann Holden, Lahontan Water Board, South Lake Tahoe office. Can you verify if the Sentry wells proposed for monitoring in lieu of the neighborhood are multi-depth wells or single-depth wells?
I don't know that off the top of my head. You have to take a...
Okay, and are they proposed for quarterly sampling?
Semi-annual within that area, unless they reduce the bound of plume, but I think they're not.
The Sentry wells would be right. Semi-annual, and then we'll check if they're multi-depth or not.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I really think we need some more informal dialogue to try to make some sense of this. It's now 10 of that's. I was hoping to give us a little more time for some informal dialogue. The item number 9, which is the status report, is a really interesting presentation this evening. So I hope everyone stays for that because I think you'll find it very informative. So I am going to make a unilateral decision that we will take 15 minutes for informal dialogue in front of the large maps over here, and hopefully some of your questions get answered that way. So we'll start item 9 at 5 after 10.